this evening on a cold Melbourne evening. You might be wondering why I'm wearing a Richmond scarf. My name's Dan Flitton. I run The Interpreter, which is the digital magazine that's published by the Lowy Institute. And I'm wearing Richmond scarf because Richmond's on top of the ladder, and this is an event about power, and it's a power. I had to. It's my team. You come, you listen, you get my joke. But I also was thinking about power. We had an event on the Power Index earlier in the year, and I made the observation at the time that we as people, as humans, we innately understand power. We spend a lot of time talking about power at all sorts of levels, in the workplace, in the family. I have a three-year-old. He understands power very well. He understands the differential between power. You know, you think that I might be able to have some over him, and I don't, not a bit. There was a really good example, I thought, this week of the difference in power between countries when Nauru made a decision to ban the ABC from coming to cover the Pacific Island Forum, and Australia sort of dismally acquiesced to this because Nauru is very important to Australia's asylum seeker processing policy, and yet Nauru is a country of barely 10,000 people versus Australia. Power manifests in very different ways. So I'm really pleased to host my colleagues. I'm based in Melbourne, but my colleagues from Sydney here this evening to be able to present on this tremendous index that the Institute is very, very pleased with. We're very grateful tonight to the NGV for agreeing to host us here. I want to get to the nitty-gritty, which is what we're here to explore this evening. And Hervé Lemanu is the director of the Asian Power and Diplomacy Program at Lowy and was formerly affiliated with the London-based International Institute for Strategic Studies. He started his career at Oxford Analytica, which is different from Cambridge Analytica. I think that's important for people to point out. Was responsible for consultancy on the Mekong region at the time. Bonnie Blay is a research fellow at the Lowy Institute, where she also worked on the Lowy Institute's Asia Power Index, and before joining Lowy was also at the IISS in London, editing a range of IISS products, including the Military Ballots and Armed Conflict Database. Which leads to my first question, Hervé. Why do this particular project, why take this on? What's different between what we've done here, or you've done, I'm going to take credit, what you've done here versus things that have come before?
Yeah. I mean, I think as you alluded to in your introduction, everyone speaks of power. You know, it's such a common terminology that we often forget that there isn't a consensus view on how to define it, let alone how to measure it. And you speak to military strategists and they will, you know, point to defense spending, and they'll point to cruisers and destroyers in the South China Sea. You speak to economists and they'll tell you about free trade agreements. You speak to cultural anthropologists and it's all about media flows and shaping opinions. But what has not been done until now is to bring all of that together. I think Joe Nye once called or once compared power, or the concept of power, to the weather. It's something that everyone talks about, but very few actually understand, because it's so complicated, it involves so many variables. We're not claiming that we are predicting the weather, but we do think that we know a thing or two about data, and bringing as much data to the fore as possible, to come up with a dispassionate assessment of the distribution of power in Asia and how quickly that's changing over time. Across all of these measures that we just spoke about in the video. It sounds simple enough, but it's actually very tricky. It was about 18 months worth of research, and the plan is to do this on an annual basis so that we can track and build a time series and see how these variables change over time and how countries perform.
Yeah, and presentation too matters. I mean, something like this
how to convey it, you could write an article about it, and I know we've run several about it, but yeah. This is the sort of thing where interactively, hopefully, an audience can involve themselves more. The nuts and bolts of it, Bonnie, how do you go about doing it? Because if what Hervé's, to use the analogy, if you're doing weather forecasting, trying to look out for storms that are on the horizon, but how do you actually go about actually just pulling this stuff together, getting hold of the data?
Yeah, well, it was a very ambitious undertaking, and we only realised that once we were already knee-deep in. And what we really have is 8 indexes rolled into one. So you could actually create a whole index out of one of those measures, each of those measures. And so the whole process largely involved identifying the right indicators. So the whole index consists of 114 indicators. These get aggregated into submeasures, and then the submeasures get aggregated into those core 8 measures of power. And finding 114 indicators out of thousands, I mean, technically millions, we probably surveyed thousands. It's only the tip of the iceberg in terms of the ones that were actually suitable. So each one had to really represent a unique element of power that no other indicator already covered. They had to be creative, capture your imagination, but also be intuitive. So you can really understand power dynamics in a really novel way. So we get, you know, refreshing new insights. The other challenge was finding data that covered all 25 countries. And we made our lives very difficult by including North Korea in this index. And I'm very glad we did, because now we have this incredible repertoire of amazing data on North Korea, which I don't think it's been done to this degree before. And lastly, we had to make sure we found sort of up-to-date data. So most of the data comes from the year 2017 and 2018, and that allows the index to really present power as it stands in Asia today. So it's a snapshot in time. The last step in bringing all this data together is to assign weightings. And this is something that every index does, but very few actually talk about it. And we've taken the opposite approach. So we really wanted to be quite transparent about the value judgments that weightings inevitably are. So we're very transparent about what our weightings are. We went through extensive consultations with lots of different experts in the region to verify those weightings, and we're happy with them. But as you saw in the video, you can actually go in as a user and manipulate those weightings according to which measures of power you think are most important. And that will vary from country to country. That will vary this year versus next year. There might be complete different priorities in terms of the Asian theater. And what we have is a real sort of data-rich exercise, which is, you know, it doesn't take any of these sort of grand narratives and just sweep along with them. It really starts to question, you know, what does the data tell us? And so the whole website was also designed, you know, with this transparency in mind. We didn't want, you know, a magic ranking that captures the headlines. We wanted a research tool, ultimately. Yeah,
and I always think about the way in which we, in our society, we pull apart and try and understand individual measures. And, you know, I'll just continue with the sporting analogy and the Tigers. But if you watch the football, and you listen to the commentators and their ability to spin out statistics about inside forward 50 turnovers and what this means for the game, it's incredible detail and it means something to coaches, but it's not done enough when you think about interactions between countries, as you guys have done here.
You should hear us when we're having a conversation. We're spitballing those statistics these days.
Yeah. And then there's an argument, and we're going to get to this in questions around the science versus the art in all of this sort of thing, how predictive you can get. But before we get to that, Hervé, what were the headlines? What shape are they?
They're an octagon, actually.
The octagons. Yeah. We have the octagons on the screen, but what does this tell us? Tell us a bit about the headlines for the octagons.
So what you see in front of you is the overall results of the index, the aggregated average of country as they perform across all of our measures. And
you briefed the White House. Yes. You launched this in New York, and you briefed the White House. So when you sat down with Donald in the Oval Office, how did you tell him how it worked?
It was Melania. She's much more intelligent. Okay.
More.
Well, we spoke to the National Security Council, so not quite Trump, and we don't know whether the message trickled up. It's likely that it didn't, given events that have followed since, but we tried. What we said is essentially, the glass is half full for the United States. Let's not be overly fatalist. There is still enormous residual power that the United States has in Asia. It has it's completely dominant in terms of its military power still. We hear a lot about how China has advanced in the South China Sea, but really it's about maritime area denial for China. It is not yet an expeditionary force. It is not yet invested in long-range force projection, nowhere near the capacity that the United States brings to Asia. I think the US has something like 83 cruisers and destroyers in the Asia-Pacific versus the 31 of all other Asian navies combined. So that power differential...
That's all others combined.
Others combined, including the Chinese PLA Navy. So that legacy effect is there to stay, and I think we're not talking about a leveling of the military balance of power for at least another decade. So on that front, you can rest easy. On another front, the other piece of good news is that the US has a commanding advantage in terms of its defense diplomacy in the region. And that is really the legacy of decades worth of alliance building. Without those alliances, if you remove defense networks out of our equation, the US and China are already leveled. But with those alliances, the United States actually has a 10-point lead over China. But again, it was a sort of warning, as much as it was a compliment to the White House, saying you risk undermining your very advantages in terms of what you're now pursuing with your foreign policy. Because the rules-based order isn't just a defense-based order. It is also to do with respect for the World Trade Organization. It is to do with how you conduct your trade policy. If you are seen to be unilateralist, you risk losing friends and the bleed over, the spillover effect, not just in terms of your economic relationships, but elsewhere, may be pronounced. So we may start seeing a bit of an unraveling effect, but for the moment, the data still shows the US to be rather strong. China, on the other hand, is an emerging power, is a peer competitor, quite clearly in Asia. It ranks as a regional superpower, so we can talk about contested US primacy. It also does incredibly well and is a consistent performer across all the measures. So it's in the top two, barring one, which is defense diplomacy. It doesn't have many friends. It doesn't command much trust, not like the United States has. Yeah. But it is number one in future trends. It's set to be the second largest, it's going to be twice as large as the US in GDP terms, in purchasing power parity by 2030, which is absolutely staggering. So all factors point to China at some point eclipsing the US, at least in terms of its resource base.
Beyond the China-US story, Japan, India, Indonesia?
So there's a massive power differential between the two frontrunners and everyone else in the index. We sort of categorize things by you've got your regional superpowers, so you've got the two-horse race between China and the US. You then have Japan and India, which form a cluster of their own. Now, the differential between China, which is ranked second, and Japan, which is ranked third, in the scoring is over 30 points. That's the equivalent distance in score between Japan and Bangladesh, ranked 18th. So that just goes to show
the gap.
But Japan and India, both strong performers, but for very different reasons. Japan is a quintessential smart power, uses its limited resources to maximum effect. It's invested in economic diplomacy going back to the 80s. In fact, it pioneered that model of merging that your foreign policy with your industrial policy, the model that China has now taken over with vigor. India, on the other hand, very large, giant of the future, set to grow by another 169 million people between today and 2030. And as far as it has a demographic dividend, it will also continue to grow in economic terms. But it is weak in terms of its defense diplomacy and in terms of its economic relationships and economic diplomacy in the rest of Asia. So we hear a lot from Narendra Modi in terms of his Act East policy, but actually the sort of influence footprint of India in the region and in East Asia and in Southeast Asia is very weak relative to the size of India. And beyond that, you have a few middle powers. Middle powers are still, they may not be the great powers and the superpowers. They can really influence the international system. Middle powers can affect the way the international system affects them, right? And they can act in concert, and they can acquiesce, or they can hedge, and they play pivotal roles in that sense. And there we have a few surprises. For example, Singapore does incredibly well, 5.6 million people. It proves its size isn't everything.
Good venue too for a summit.
Excellent convening power, as we've seen recently. And other much larger countries like Indonesia are in our top 10, but you know they're disappointed, obviously, to see that they are not ranked as highly as some of their neighbours, including some of the smallest.
I want to get to something, Bonnie, that you've got a part of this, the index, as a kind of secondary analysis, is that gap, that power gap. Underachievers and overachievers. Why does Singapore get to host the thing, to get to host the summit? But what is it that makes an overachiever and an underachiever when you look at this index?
Yeah, so while we were collecting all this data, coming up with our overall power rankings, we realized there was another story to be told, and that's called the power gap. So you'll notice at the top there we've got resources for the first four measures. That's economic resources, military capability, resilience, and future trends. So that's really your material assets. But we also have four influence measures. So that's your diplomatic influence, your defense networks, your cultural influence, and your economic relationships. And so one of them, you know, the resources are what you have, and influence is what you do with what you have in Asia. And what you can do is you can, to get nerdy here, you can form a linear regression between the two, and you can predict on the basis of the size and resources of a country what influence they're expected to have. And what we find is countries are either overachievers, as you mentioned, or underachievers. So the countries that are above that line are our overachievers, those below are underachievers. And any country sitting on the line is roughly proportionate, so it's performing as you might expect it to. So just to give you a few examples, you mentioned Singapore. Yes, Singapore is definitely an overachiever. It is a little red dot on the map. As Hervé mentioned, 5.6 million people. I mean, that is very small landmass, small population, small demographic power. But it's, as you said, its convening power is enormous. It's ranked first for its for PM Lee's, his what is it, his foreign policy?
His efficacy, as a political
that's
leader.
Right.
Yeah. And I think if anybody remembers a few years ago, Kevin Rudd tried to launch an Asia-Pacific community. Singapore got in the way. Yeah,
that's right.
It's extraordinary. Small little city state.
It is really extraordinary. So the other overachiever that is worth noting is Japan. So Japan is actually our number one overachiever. And that's kind of interesting considering the narrative we tend to hear about Japan is one of decline, one of sort of demographic decline. So it's predicted to lose 8 million people of working age population between now and 2030. But actually, on the influence side, it is consistently strong. So it has the second best diplomatic network in the region. It's the most Googled country in Asia, which is really interesting. So there's some sort of cultural pull. And when we mapped out the media landscape, we found that its pull, especially in Southeast Asia, is very strong. It's also the third most popular university destination for international students from the Asian region. So there's lots of evidence that, you know, there may be a story of decline in terms of Japan's resources, but its legacy of influence holds strong.
Just don't ask the whales, but I just mentioned that. Apropos nothing. No, it's fascinating where Japan comes. But who are the who in that sense then are the underachievers?
Underachievers, yeah. So so one interesting underachiever is actually Taiwan. So Taiwan is a very strong economy. So it ranks 15th overall in the index. That's taking into account all eight variable or all eight measures. But it's actually a top 10 economy. It's ranked fourth for its productivity. It's got a very sophisticated economy. But it's diplomatic isolation. It's not formally recognized by any other country in Asia. Really comes at a cost in terms of its influence in the region, and we saw that in our results. The other interesting example is Russia. So Russia, we've included in this index, though it is somewhat a geographic outsider. It does have its Pacific Fleet in Vladivostok. But actually, it has immense resources. So it's got, you know, the third largest military in the Asian region, according to our ranking. Huge energy exporter, fifth largest economy. However, its influence is quite severely hampered by the fact that it invests all its resources into Europe and the Middle East. So it doesn't have much bandwidth for Asia. And in fact, when we looked at our economic relationships measure, Russia ranks 16th. So it's not trading much, it's not doing much investment, it's not doing much economic diplomacy with the region. And so actually, for that reason, it's an underachiever. It has unfulfilled potential in terms of its influence in Asia.
And yet, presentation. I travelled with Julia Gillard to Vladivostok in 2012, and I'll never forget Vladimir Putin flew in a light aircraft with a flock of geese.
Yeah.
Why? Didn't take his shirt off that time. North Korea.
Yeah.
Maybe the biggest surprise in all this. You were telling me just before we came on stage tonight, this is something that you get the most questions about. And
yeah.
Given North Korea is in the news all the time, surely yeah. North Korea is a very powerful
country. Interestingly, before I move into North Korea, one of the untold angles of Russia's influence in Asia is that they actually have quite a strong relationship with North Korea. And Putin made a point in his first term presidency to sign a treaty which includes a defense consultation clause. So that, you know, the Russians have had their own sort of pivot to Asia. It's not a sort of whimpered, but they've had the blueprint for a pivot to Asia for some time, and inheriting that Soviet legacy as well. So using those old ties, especially with Vietnam, India is another sort of traditional partner. But moving to North Korea, I mean, this is I'd say probably one of our most interesting results, because it provokes the strongest reactions in people. Either people think it should be higher, or either, you know, we've had some reactions suggesting it should be even lower. But essentially, we take a very broad-ranging view of power, as we've already explained. And there's no denying that North Korea is a very dangerous military power. It ranks in the top five. It's invested all its eggs in that one basket. I think 8% of its working age population is conscripted into the armed forces. So it has twice the armed forces of South Korea, despite having half the population of South Korea. And then obviously, as we know, its nuclear program is fairly well established, and its intercontinental ballistic missile range. But that has come at an enormous cost to society. An estimated 25% of North Korea's GDP is plowed into defense spending, and that has resulted in an absolutely paralyzed and dysfunctional economy.
Just in relative terms there, what's Australia now in defense spending?
Seventh. Yeah. Is that...
Of GDP as a percentage.
Oh, it's something you out here, but... like...
Aiming for 2%, I think.
Aiming for 2%, yeah, close to 2%.
Aiming for 2%, yeah, and they're 25.
They're 25.
Extraordinary,
isn't it? The US is on 3.6%, and China's hardly breaking a sweat. It's on 1.9%. So, that, you know, I mean, if you see that moving up as a proportion of GDP, that's when we should start worrying, really. When it comes to North Korea, then, I think we actually have a regime that is presenting itself as from a position of strength, when in fact it's much weaker than we give it credit for. We've overrated North Korea's power. So much of that power is actually plowed into theatrics, into notoriety, into disruption. But the fundamentals are very alarming. If I were to sit in Pyongyang, it has to operate as a sort of criminal syndicate in terms of its economic relationships. For those reasons, it only emerges 17th. So it's an asymmetric power. We've also called it a misfit middle power. For a number of reasons, when you take a holistic view of its strengths and weaknesses, it comes out much weaker than it looks strong.
So the largest underachiever in the region.
By far, yeah.
Amazing way to think about it.
Huh. Yeah. And consider also the fact that it's lost out on its integration into Factory Asia, the supply chains that crisscross the borders, the free trade agreements, this whole new architecture of interdependencies, in exchange for what? Pariah status, which has some benefits, particularly for Kim Jong-un, on the whole comes at an enormous cost.
I'd also explain why he's so attracted to Donald Trump building condos on the North Korean beachsides, but... Bonnie, what about Australia? We talked a bit about the military comparison just there briefly, but what does this measure, what does the index tell us? Tell us about Australia.
So Australia ranks sixth overall in the index. To us, that was quite a high ranking. And to most Australians that we've spoken to, that was quite a high ranking. Interestingly enough, when we were in the US launching this a month ago, their reaction was, that actually sounds lower than we thought. So it's interesting to put the data against these gut perceptions. But basically, Australia does very well in sixth place because it's a consistent performer. So across all eight measures, it does extremely well. It has no one big weakness. That's definitely the good news. We see it's, you know, it does it particularly well in terms of in terms of its resilience. So it's ranked, I think, third for its resilience. It's got very strong institutional stability, but also geographically, it's effectively a continental moat. It has a moat around this continent. It has no interstate conflicts with its neighbors. It's resolved its minor maritime dispute with Timor-Leste. So it's in a very good position in terms of its resilience. Defense networks, it also does extremely well. So it's ranked second, and that's largely down to its really strong relationship with the U.S., And you know, you could argue that its relationship with the U.S. is stronger than the U.S.'s allied relationships with, say, South Korea. There's a really strong history there. And so Australia does pretty well in that sense, too. There are some downsides in terms of its performance. So most significantly, perhaps, we noticed that Australia really lacks diversity in terms of its relationships. So I mentioned on the security side, the U.S. is its main partner, and almost its only partner in many things. And we think, you know, more diplomatic defense engagement with, say, India, South Korea, Japan, Indonesia would be quite helpful. But also economically, it's not very diversified in its partners. So when it comes to trade, 29% of Australia's trade is with its main partner, which is China. But you look at all the other countries in Asia, their dependency on their main partner is significantly lower. So I think that does present a vulnerability. And when it comes to investment, Australia tends to stick to its sort of Anglospheric friends. So it invests more in New Zealand than it does in all 10 of its ASEAN partners, which is pretty remarkable. So I think we could see a bit of an improvement there. But I think overall the result is very good news for Australians, and that sort of strain of self-doubt that we often see and the reactions that we've received aren't necessarily warranted. Australia does have quite a significant role to play in Asia, and I think that's what the index really shows.
New Zealand question is fascinating, isn't it? I mean, I wonder, and we won't have an answer for this, but I just wonder whether this is diaspora communities, lots of migrants, those sorts of, and as you say, Anglo-Saxon ties. It's interesting how much weight it gets to in officialdom in Canberra, as you know, views of Wellington, Five Eyes, sharing of intelligence, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
We got a lot of media for the Lowy Institute out of this, out of the index. And I'm going to move to audience questions just after this. But one of the things that the media focused on was Australia's poor showing when you look to do some projections into the future, when you've tried to use the index to be predictive. Should we be worried? Are we headed into dangerous shoals?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's some challenges ahead. Things don't get easier. One of the reasons we felt compelled to include a sort of forward-looking or future-oriented measure there is that it has such a big role in terms of our perceptions of power. So it's not just what you have today, but it's what you may have tomorrow that informs decision-making on the part of others who may be for or against you. The fact that we see China not only as powerful today, number two, but because we think, as you know, that it may at some point eclipse the United States, actually has people much more wary or much more inclined to acquiesce to China's rise. So we needed to include that future trends component. Now, when it comes to Australia and many developed economies, it's just a simple matter of fact that even if you continue growing at healthy rates for developed economies, say 3% annually, there's no way, you know, in relative terms, you're still declining. You're still declining when it comes to rankings of economic size of your neighbors who are still developing at much faster rates because they haven't finished that curve yet. And so sure enough, Australia's economy at the moment moment is the 8th largest. By 2030, we're forecasting will be the 11th largest, which is, you know, it's a slip in the rankings. In terms of defense expenditure, we think Australia will remain level as the 7th largest defense spender. And in demographic terms, it's more or less stable. In fact, it eclipses Taiwan, because Taiwan is an aging society like a lot of East Asian countries are. So it's a sort of a mixed picture, but it's clear that essentially in terms of the share of the resources pie in Asia, the relative share declines for Australia. But there's no reason not to think that Australia couldn't continue to overachieve. I mean, let's take stock of the fact that today we rank Australia as the 6th most influential country in Asia when it has a population that's smaller than Nepal. So why couldn't you continue overachieving as the 11th largest economy in Asia? So we don't want to be too deterministic in terms of saying just because we're forecasting your economy and your demographics and your military expenditure, those are indicative but not the whole picture of the future balance of power.
Here we are. Since the 1960s, we've been debating, are we the lucky country? I want to invite the audience to ask some questions. I'm hoping to see a couple of hands maybe fly up if we can.
Yes, I've got two related questions. The first one is, you have a series of disaggregated indices. How do you get the weights to determine the importance of the different indices? And related to that, when you bring together a series of indices into an aggregate index, usually you go through a process of trying to validate it by predicting something from the aggregate index that you cannot get from the disaggregated indices. So has your index allowed you to make prediction, some empirical prediction, or is it just sort of bringing together a series of indices which are, the whole is not really more than the summation of the parts?
Don't mind who tackles it.
Well, I can start and you can happily jump in. So that's actually a really good question. The weightings, I'll show you the weightings calculator while we're chatting, but basically the weightings work for a user. It doesn't look like it's working here. So for a user, you can choose to manipulate the weightings on the measure level, and we've assigned the weightings on the levels below that, so on the sub-measure and the indicator level. And we did a lot of sensitivity analysis to see the impact that weightings have. And we were actually surprised to find that the movements are quite marginal when you equalize all the weightings. So we were relieved to see the impact is fairly moderate. The much greater variable in determining the results is which indicators you choose to begin with. But about the aggregate, aggregating these 8 measures and then coming to one final ranking, I think there is value in doing that, but it should be taken with a pinch of salt. And actually, the more granular you go, you get other insights that are also equally telling, sometimes more telling. And so the more you aggregate, it can get diluted. But I think actually we draw some larger trends out of the overall findings that are still valuable. And we do encourage you to go into the index and delve right into each measure and look at each of the component parts, and you'll see how all this aggregation tells lots of different layers of stories, each valuable in their own way, I think, yeah.
We don't mean to undermine the value of the overall result, because there is value, actually. Power is something that works in a specific frame of reference, so it's sort of a situational advantage. So there's no question.
3-year-old.
Yeah, exactly. Or Nauru, or it depends. I mean, a specific factor which maybe has no relevance today, tomorrow might become incredibly relevant. So there's no question that as situations change, different variables become more or less important. That's also why we've introduced the calculator. So it's a relational quality. It's something that exists between A and B, actor A and B. But there's no question that the countries that perform best or are consistent performers across these different dimensions of power are best placed to respond to a dynamic region which is changing before our eyes. So we don't know whether we're going to be confronting a military war or sort of an altercation or that leads to a larger regional conflict in South China Sea, or whether we're really talking about economic diplomacy as being the main medium of influence. So really, given that how much is changing in Asia's geopolitics, as a country, you want to be able to invest across all these eight measures. And what the final result does is reward those countries that are consistent performers across these multiple means of projecting and exercising power. Asymmetric powers like North Korea get punished because you're only good at one thing. And if you're only good at nuclear power or nuclear capability, it gets you nowhere unless you actually want to use that button. But then you invite sort of retaliation, which would destroy the regime. So you can really only use it as a sort of blunt tool for deterrence and disruption for theatrics, but it doesn't get you really further. So we reward countries that do well across the measures. We also want to expose those countries that do well at certain things and flatline at others.
Just at the front here. First, a comment. I was really surprised to see how low Indonesia was, given its role in ASEAN, demographic dividend, resources, and so on. But I look forward to looking at that in my own time. My question was about leaders. And you talked about the theatrics of North Korea. We're really talking about the theatrics of Kim Jong-un, same with Trump, Duterte, even in Malaysia with the change of leadership. How is the leader of the time captured in all of this? And is it one of those things that would be more heavily weighted than others? Because instinctively it is, and I guess that's the benefit of having a data-driven analysis.
So you're asking about whether...
Is the personality yeah. who's the head of yeah. a country reflected in any of these measures?
Absolutely.
Because in a non-evidence-based way, it instinctively feels like it would be a big factor in a country's influence in the region.
Yeah. So, I mean, firstly, on Indonesia, I think we're not denying its potential. So, yes, it has the demography, it has the natural resources. But actually, this is where political leadership also plays a big role, because it's not just what you have, it's your level of ambition, your strategic intent, how far you want to go, how much you want to underwrite ASEAN. And it's true to say that Indonesia plays a role as one of the founding members of ASEAN, but it could be doing much more. And until we see that, we're only talking about potential, whereas here we're tracking actual influence as it stands today. So coming back to your question on political leaders, yes, it is an enormously important variable, but one that's very hard to track in data. And it's actually one of the few indicators where we've gone to a qualitative assessment, because there's really no other way of doing it. So what we've done is assembled a group of geographically representative policymakers and academics and asked them to rate the efficacy of every political leader in terms of pursuing their diplomatic interests in Asia. And irrespective of whether that's right or wrong, just the efficacy. So Kim Jong-un is actually highly efficient using the limited resources he has at his disposal to secure a summit with the world's most powerful individual. Now, we haven't seen the rewards of that yet, but just the fact that it happens is status enhancing. And again, masquerades, I think, weakness for strength. Donald Trump, on the other hand, was rated sort of parallel with Prime Minister Hun Sen in Cambodia for his ability or inability to pursue...
It's very mean to Hun Sen. Very mean.
No comments. Yeah. But at least the perception in Asia, overwhelmingly, is that he has not been particularly effective at pursuing the United States' interests. However those are conceived, and that might have something to do with the fact that it's taken, the U.S. administration has really taken a tunnel vision view of Asia policy. It's reduced its Asia policy to the dimension of North Korea, and I think that's a real risk. I mean, it's another point we made to the White House.
There's another aspect to all of this, if I just jump in too, is how can you measure the non-state actors in these sorts of indexes? Do you look at multinational corporations, for instance, when we talk a lot about Google and the effect of Google being able to move its tax around, obviously Al-Qaeda had a tremendous impact on world affairs as a non-state actor. Is that something that you've looked at, or have you limited yourself, because you've got to put limits on it, limited yourself to countries?
So, I mean, it is a state-driven kind of prism that we've opted for, but so much of what a country's clout, you know, looks like in Asia is not actually down to government policy. It's down to the fact that you have successful multinationals who are actively engaged in investing and trading, and or cultural influence. I mean, we look at people exchanges, tourism flows, diaspora communities. We look at the success of Korean soap operas and all sorts of things which aren't really directly government policy at all, but in some way, in some very important way, play a secondary role in reinforcing or depriving countries of influence. So yes, it's a state-driven model, but so much of this, particularly in cultural influence, but also in terms of economic relationships, is driven by non-state actors, which reinforce the overall clout of countries and region.
Just going down this current discussion, in your analysis, if we move back from how a state interacts with all the other states in the region on your eight and your subsidiary things, and we go just to state power within the state itself, and the relationship of state power with its own populations and the diversity within its own populations, and come back to your concept of resilience, to what extent can you have movements which result in an overthrow of the government, as which happened in Thailand temporarily, because there's a lack of legitimacy of the government that's in power, and they haven't really managed their minorities, which is a case of Tibet, a possibility in Xinjiang right now, even though state power is particularly strong. You even have Xi Jinping saying, I'm worried about the legitimacy of the Communist Party. Mm. So obviously, if there's a revolution in some of these countries, there's a massive change in its influence in the relationship of other countries with these things. Just how do you handle that in your index?
You ask a very important question, which we were really keen to include as well. So you're right, that sits under resilience. And you know, some questions we initially got while we were forming the model was, why are you including resilience at all? This whole project is about power projection. But the fact of the matter is, you can't project power if you don't have a fundamental threshold of resilience and stability internally. It's a prerequisite that every country needs to have. And so you might find some countries like Myanmar have a very strong military capability, but that military, its bandwidth is occupied with internal stability and internal turmoil. So that isn't necessarily at all an addition in terms of projecting power. And if anything, that's a hindrance. So if you look under institutional stability, you could definitely do an index on this alone, and I'm sure people have. But we looked at six proxy indicators, including internal conflict, low intensity, but also high intensity, because not all conflict has the same impact on a whole country. But we also looked at government effectiveness and political stability. So, for example, Pakistan is at the bottom of the pack when it comes to political stability, and Singapore is first. So it was a variable we thought was really important to include for the points that you made as well. Mm.
And as to your point about China, I mean, we actually ran an interpreter piece a few weeks back by Richard McGregor, The Collapse of the China Collapse Theory, which is to say that for some time...
It was in the Fin Review, but...
Okay, well, there we go. It's available on the Lowy Institute website.
I'm sure it is. Everybody should go and look at the website.
That's where I spotted it. He is basically saying, well, you know, for some years now, we've been talking about an impending existential crisis for Communist Party rule in China. And that's something that the communist authorities are quite alert to as well. I mean, we're not claiming necessarily that we can predict these things in their entirety. But I think the big challenges for China are probably not existential. They're going to hinder or handicap its ability to project power, but they're not going to existentially threaten the existence of the state. And there are countries that are much worse affected by political instability. And as Bonnie was saying, that hinders their ability to project power. It also makes them much more vulnerable to being influenced by others, proxy wars and so forth.
Yeah, I was at one time an intelligence analyst for the Australian government and then became a journalist. And one of the things that's really useful about these sorts of indexes is not necessarily their predictive power, as important as that is, but also just the ability to prompt you to ask questions. And I think that that's one of the great things about this, is if you can look at these varied measures and just think about their interaction and ask questions about them, that in itself invites you to sort of explore things more and perhaps then make some predictions. I had another question just here in the middle.
Fascinating discussion. One of the big factors in the next 30 years is population growth. And if you look, China goes backwards over 30 years, Japan goes backwards over 30 years, but in our northwestern corridor, the projections are from Pakistan through to Indonesia for an extra 600 to 650 million people, which is the equivalent of Europe in the next 30 years. Europe is relatively stable, the Americas are relatively stable, but Africa in that time grows by the equivalent of the Americas altogether, which prompts the question, or it prompts two questions. Where do we fit population growth-wise in Australia? There are some who would argue that we should be restraining our population growth. Personally, I think that's a mistake. But the second question is, where does Asia fit in terms of power relative to the other continents, to Europe, to Central Asia perhaps, to Africa and to the Americas?
Mm. So I think by 2025, Asia, broadly conceived, will account for 2/3 of the world's population versus just a tenth for all Western countries combined. So that's EU and the US, and North America. So that gives you a sense just of the staggering, actually, differential there in demographics, and it makes complete sense that we talk about an Asian century in that sense. But within Asia, you have, as you quite rightly point out, different sub-regions. And it's remarkable some countries are aging and aging really fast, and that seems to be more of an East Asian phenomenon. It's a Japanese problem, but it's also a Chinese problem. That, as you say, that we're looking at it in terms of working age population. China will be have a working age population that's 40 million people smaller than what it has today in 2030, so that we're talking about 10 years. So that's going to pose structural, societal, economic problems for China. Maybe not existential, but it will be an issue. India, on the other hand, adding 169 million people. There is no way that Australia could rival that sort of demographic dividend, and there's no way I think we could espouse in policy terms something that would be politically acceptable, that would really dramatically accelerate the population. But I would say Australia has a bit of it's in the Goldilocks zone. It's not aging, and it's not rapidly growing either. It could perhaps grow a bit more in terms of our assessment of power. That would be good. But otherwise, rapid growth is also of population is a double-edged sword. I mean, India is going to have to find productive use for a very young population, and we know that underemployment can also cause political instability. So that's going to be the big challenge for countries that are growing, and it will be a challenge for neighbours as well. As you say, in Europe, they're having issues at the moment.
Now, I've got a couple more hands up, but we're running also out of time, so we have about five more minutes. It was just in the middle here, I think.
Thank you. Very interesting presentation. I'm quite amazed that Australia would be sixth. And 30 years ago, I was lectured that Japan's weakness is it has no raw materials, no resources. Its strength was that it has no raw materials, no resources. And you look at Singapore, which is, punching John Howard very much above its weight in this state. Australia has sort of, I spent a lot of time in Indonesia, and Australia is a non-event in Indonesia, and most Australians know very, very little about Indonesia. I'm fascinated that we influence anybody with the American gaze that we have, and that our foreign policy is so American oriented. Is there any explanation for, you know, why non, you know, countries with you know, very low natural resources seem to be, you know, doing so well in your table?
I mean, they're probably having to innovate more and focus on their services, the service economy and things like that. I mean, I think you're right to say that Australia is very wedded to the United States, and that means that it's very wedded to the future prospects of the United States and very vulnerable to the possibility of a U.S. retrenchment in the U.S., and then there would be a big knock-on effect for Australia's position in the region. So that was what Bonnie was saying, this sort of dual dependency in economic terms for China and in defense terms for the U.S. is particularly acute for Australia, even in the Asian scenario where we see that other countries are better diversified. But on the other hand, you know, I think Australia deserves credit. A whole generation of Southeast Asian leaders have studied at the ANU or at the University of Sydney. Australia is the second most popular university destination for Asian students. That shapes and creates a sort of affinity for Australia, which is perhaps an underused capital, but it exists. So there are some surprising findings here. We don't deny that Australia could do better in terms of diversifying its ties, but it is present and active.
We've got time for a couple more.
I was reading recently that some of the most important economic indicators are GDP per person and also investment per person. And this article went on to say that China was around 30 lower in the ranking for GDP and 300 for investment per person. And in that terms, America and even Australia are far in advance of those indicators for China. So I just wanted to know, did you take any cognizance of that in your index?
And I'll just add, there's also fascinating data from the World Bank recently around infrastructure and the benefit that countries have from having long tail investment in infrastructure over a long period of time, whereas China has obviously built a lot in recent times. The cost through that.
So GDP per capita is something that a lot of people have asked us about, and actually we do cover it in another way by looking at productivity. So that basically is very highly correlated, and that's under economic resources. So we do look at that to some extent. But on the other hand, to some degree, it doesn't necessarily matter how wealthy an individual is. So it's actually useful that, for example, in India, where GDP per capita will be quite low compared to some other countries in the region, its sheer demographic size actually can make up for that. So you can have a very productive country and a very sort of powerful player through sheer numbers. So there's a bit of a balance to strike there, I think. You know, and India has its own Silicon Valley. It has, you know, it's got a lot of things going for it. But I think its ranking in fourth place in the index is largely owed down to its sheer size.
The advantages of scale. I mean, even China's domestic economy is so large, and it's because it's centrally planned. The industrial scale implementation of new technologies is pretty much unprecedented anywhere else in the world.
Oh, but we have the NBN.
Oh, well. Perhaps.
We're out of time, and one of the firm rules with the Lowy Institute is that we do finish on time. I'm fascinating. It's great, frankly, to have more questions than we can answer, because it's an indication of a good night. I've been sitting here with a scarf on under the power of the lights, and you think about the way in which power infuses all of our lives in so many different manifestations. I think it's terrific that these guys have managed to break it up into some measurable indexes here for you to... We invite you to go and have a play with the website. It's as interactive and as easy and as complex as you choose to make it. Can you please thank Hervé and Bonnie for coming tonight?